Well, the last chapters in Judges, along with the book of Ruth, provides us three episodes from the pre-king period of Hebrew history. Ruth is a ray of sunshine. Her story shows how a few people willingly placed principle above pleasure. But Ruth was the exception. The stories in Judges 17 to 21 were more indicative of the times. They revealed just how far a society deteriorates when everyone does what is right in their own eyes. I call it the Outback philosophy. Outback Steakhouse, you know, used to have a commercial where a truckload of good-looking blokes and Sheilas, they drive past these warning signs onto the beach. They break the law to have a frolicking party complete with blooming onions and delicious steaks. All the while, the spokesperson chants the Outback motto, "No rules, just right." Well, once I was at an Outback Steakhouse, and I asked my waiter if I could substitute cheese fries for regular fries. Easy enough. Wasn't like I was asking for the moon. You would have thought, though, I wanted to change the U.S. Constitution. The waiter was adamant. No way. And why? It was against the rules. I remember telling him, "Wait a minute. What about your motto? No rules, just right." Well, I learned that day that the motto only applied when it was in the restaurant's favor. And this is what happens with an amoral society. All civilization requires rules. But when you toss out God's rules, the only rules left are those made by powerful people to serve their own selfish interests. The results are nasty and brutal. Consider the last five chapters of the book of Judges. Well, the first story in chapters 17 and 18 centers around a man named Micah. I call him Messed Up Mike. Chapter 17 shows how convoluted his life had become. Now, there was a man from the mountains of Ephraim whose name was Micah. And he said to his mother, "The 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you and on which you put a curse, even saying it in my ears, here is the silver with me. I took it." Now, the first thing we learn about Messed Up Mike is that he stole money from his own mother. I mean, how low can you go? Maybe he was betting on NFL games, had a bet on the Super Bowl. Maybe he was into online poker, I don't know. But he needed the silver, perhaps, to feed his addiction. Well, he confesses to his messes only when he realizes mama's money comes with a curse. His mother said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my son." So when he had returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother said, "I had wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to the Lord, Yahweh, for my son, to make a carved image and a molded image. Now, therefore, I will return it to you." And here's where it gets really bizarre. Messed Up Mike has a messed up mom. She had dedicated this silver to Yahweh to make a carved image for her son. But graven images were forbidden by God. A graven image was forbidden in the second of the Ten Commandments. She attempts to honor God by violating his own commands. Like the guy who stole a Bible so he could attend a Bible study. That's messed up. Well, this woman wants to serve God, but obviously in her own way. And how many people today have that same idea? Lots of folks want to tip their hat to God, but not give up any control of their lives. That's messed up for sure. Well, thus he returned the silver to his mother. Then his mother took 200 shekels of silver and gave them to the silversmith, and he made it into a carved image and a molded image, and they were in the house of Micah. Now, here's an oxymoron. A visible image of the unseen God. She takes this money, she gives it to the silversmith, to make an image of Yahweh. She wants to confine the Almighty to a talisman, to a good luck charm. Verse 5, the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod and household idols, and he consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. In the name of the one true God, Micah constructs his own shrine. He sets up his own image of God. He makes his own priestly uniform or ephod. He selects his own priest. He violates every detail of God's law in an attempt to worship God. Recall, private shrines were forbidden by God. Old Testament worship was corporate, not private. It was highly centralized worship. Worship was to be carried out in the tabernacle by the Levites. Micah and son were from the tribe of Ephraim. Graven images were not to aid in worship. You remember what Jesus told the Samaritan woman? God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. Verse 6 sums up Micah's problem. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. There was a side to Micah that desired to be spiritual. Perhaps he had a real longing for God. Most people do. But rather than submit to God's will and pursue him in the way he requires, Micah opted for a tailor-made religion, for his own brand of spirituality. See, Micah wanted to be spiritual and religious, but his spirituality had little to do with the Bible. Rather, it was a hodgepodge of Judaism and superstition and the occult. It was based on experience and preference, not the truth of God's word. Hey, welcome to our modern world. Every survey today tells us that interest in spirituality is up, 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 while commitment to biblical truth is down. In his book, American Demographics, Cimino and Latin, they explain what kind of religion people today desire. It's a religion of the heart, not of the head. It's practical and personal. More about stress reduction than salvation. More therapeutic than theological. It's about feeling good, not being good. It's as much about the body as it is about the soul. People want a convenient spirituality without moral absolutes and ultimate authority. They want a designer religion, not biblical truth. They're happy to embrace Jesus as a potential guide or helper or coach or friend. But Jesus is Lord doesn't fit with modern notions of spirituality. I once saw an article in the Washington Post titled, "A Church Away from Church." Apparently, there is a growing trend today toward establishing prayer rooms or meditation seats or home altars. People are creating their own sacred space at home. One lady spoke of the bedroom altar that she has. It symbolizes an amalgam of personal beliefs and experiences, provides me with a more intimate and meaningful form of worship than any religious institution could offer. Her altar has several idols or goddesses in it, Roman Catholic candles, items held sacred by Native Americans. It's mixed up Mike all over again. Today's spirituality is a quagmire of religious sentiment divorced from biblical truth. It's a heretical blend, and it has very little to do with Christianity. Well, mixed up Mike's situation worsens in verse 7. Now, there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah. He was a Levite and was staying there. One day, a real bona fide priest stumbles into the picture, a Levite with the proper credentials. Micah thinks that he can gain legitimacy for his own religion by hiring his own priest. And so he makes an offer. Verse 10, "Dwell with me and be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 shekels of silver per year, a suit of clothes, and your sustenance." 10 shekels, a suit of new clothes, and room and board. He buys himself a priest. And so the Levite went in, Then the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man became like one of his sons to him. And so Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in his house. Messed up Mike buys himself a priest. And now this priest is on the payroll, so he's going to tell Mike exactly what he wants to hear. And I'm afraid there are a lot of watered-down churches today that have done exactly the same thing. They buy their own Levite to preach to them week after week, but only what they want to hear. Well, then Mike said, "Now I know that the Lord will be good to me since I have a Levite as priest." Notice his faith is nothing but superstition. This Levite served as a good luck charm. And this is how some folks feel about going to church today. Oh, they come, but they come hoping it makes them lucky the next week. The whole setup was a gross violation of God's law. I want you to drop down to chapter 18, verse 31, for there the author reminds us. "So they set up for themselves Micah's carved image, which he made. All the time that the house of God was in Shiloh." While all this was going on with Micah, the house of God, the God-sanctioned form of worship, was in Shiloh. God-ordained worship was at the tabernacle. Micah was spiritual, but he was not obedient. Spirituality and godliness, friends, are not the same thing. You can be spiritual, yet ignore God's revealed truth. Spiritual people can miss God and worship the wrong spirit. Godliness is spirituality that obeys God's word. And this is why you need more than a personal guru or a spiritual trainer. True spirituality, a real connection to God, can't be personalized to private tastes. Religion a la carte is trendy, but true worship is all about worshiping God the way He wants and desires to be worshiped. Well, chapter 18. "In those days there was no king in Israel. And in those days the tribe of the Danites was seeking an inheritance for itself to dwell in. For until that day, their inheritance among the tribes of Israel had not fallen to them." Well, it hadn't fallen to them because they hadn't seized it. You see, Dan had been allotted a tract of land along the South Canaan coast. But Philistines were inhabiting Dan's territory, and they lacked the courage to drive out the occupants. Rather than fight, it was easier to flee. And so they send 5 men in search of an easier place to dwell. And as they pass through the mountains of Ephraim, guess who they hook up with? They spend the night at Mixed Up Mike's house. And they recognize the priest that he had just hired. In verse 3, they ask him, "Who brought you here? What are you doing in this place?" And so the Levite tells them about the deal that he's made with Micah. And they ask him to bless their journey. And they do find a new tract of land to settle. A city called Laish, north of the Sea of Galilee, on the border between Israel and Sidon, was a mountain town. It was near the headwaters of the Jordan River. In fact, if you visit Israel with us, we'll take you on a hike in the Dan Nature Reserve. It's fun to go up that way. But that was where Laish was. The land was rich and fertile. And there weren't Philistines, troublesome Philistines there that they had to drive out. It would be easier for them. Laish's northern neighbor, Sidon, lived more on the Mediterranean coast, leaving Laish isolated. In essence, Laish was unattended prime real estate. And so in verses 8 through 10, the spies return and they convince the Danites they need to move there. Verse 11, "And 600 men of the family of the Danites went from there, from Zorah and Eshtol, armed with weapons of war." And on their way to Laish, the Danites again stop in the mountains of Ephraim at the house of messed up Mike and his messed up priest. Verse 14. "Now then the 5 men who had gone to spy out the country of Laish answered and said to their brethren, Do you know that there are in these houses an ephod, household idols, a carved image, and a molded image? Now, therefore, consider what you should do. Rather than seek God's will, notice the suggestion. Consider what you should do. This was when everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes. And so they turned aside there and came to the house of the young Levite man, to the house of Micah, and greeted him. The Danites, though, don't just greet him. They grab his idols, his priestly clothes, his religious trinkets. And in verse 18, the Levite asks them, "What are you doing?" They said to him, "Oh, be quiet. Put your hand over your mouth." Shh. They shush him. "And come with us. And be a father and a priest to us. And listen to the offer they make. It is better for you to be a priest to the household of one man, or that you be a priest to the tribe and a family in Israel." When the priest tries to stop the thieves, they buy him off. You can be a priest to a big tribe, not just one house. And again, notice the offer. It is better for you to be a priest to the household of one man, or that you be a priest to a tribe. Hey, come with us, and you can pastor a bigger church. That's what they say. Hey, he wasn't committed to Micah. This priest was a hired gun. He's a priest for sale. He was open to the highest bidder. You know, they say every man has his price. That was certainly true of this Levite. He was a sellout. Turns out this priest wasn't committed to God or Micah, and it's sad today when a pastor pursues a better offer, a more lucrative job rather than God's will. Why are pastors never called to a smaller church? It's always a bigger church, isn't it? And so the priest's heart was glad, and he took the ephod, the household idols, and the carved image, and took his place among the people. He took his religion, and he married it with the Danites. And then they turned and departed and put the little ones, the livestock, and the goods in front of them. Everyone's doing what's right in their own eyes. Of course, Micah and his neighbors refuse to take this lying down. They come after the priest, verse 23. And so the Danites turned around and said to Micah, "What ails you that you have gathered such a company?" So he said, "You have taken away my gods, which I made, and the priest, and you have gone away. How foolish to worship a God that you created." The God that I made, he says. How foolish to worship a God you created rather than the God who created you. And yet Micah despairs. "Now what more do I have? How can you say to me, 'What ails you?'" And the children of Dan said to him, "Do not let your voice be heard among us, lest angry men fall upon you and you lose your life in the lives of your household." And as I said in the beginning, when a society throws out God's laws, then the rules are made by people in power for their own advantage. The law of the jungle goes into effect. It's now might makes right. And then the children of Dan went their way, and when Micah saw that they were too strong for him, he turned and he went back to his house. How tragic to worship a God that can be stolen. Here's the problem with today's feel-good faith, with today's recipe religion. It doesn't survive tough times. Storms can steal away your faith. Only a faith tied to the rock, to the one true God, Jesus Christ, can never be stolen. Well, the rest of chapter 18 tells us how the city of Laish was defeated and burned and then renamed Dan. And the Levite, his name was Jonathan, served as the tribe's own personal priest. He was the best priest money could buy. But according to verse 31, all the while God's sanctioned priesthood ministered in Shiloh. Designer religion might make you feel good, but it never pleases God. And here's another problem with wrong worship. It produces wrong living. Always, ungodliness leads to unrighteousness. If you believe wrong, eventually you'll behave wrong. It's been said, when God goes, anything goes. And the final grisly story in Judges shows just how utterly immoral ungodly people become. I got to warn you, this story is going to cause the hair on the back of your neck to stand straight up. Chapter 19. And it came to pass in those days, when there was no king in Israel, that there was a certain Levite staying in the remote mountains of Ephraim. This is a different Levite, but also living in the mountains of Ephraim. He was of the tribe of Benjamin. He took for himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. And again, this is indicative of the moral decline in Israel at the time, that a Levite, a man of God no less, takes a concubine. See, concubines were never God's idea. Concubines were common in antiquity. Hagar, remember, was Abraham's concubine. Jacob had two concubines. A concubine was a legal mistress, officially bound but with fewer privileges than a wife. She was considered a man's property. And here, a Levite, no less, had taken a concubine. But his concubine played the harlot against him and went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah and was there 4 whole months. And the Levite pondered what he should do. He decides finally to go after her, speak kindly to her, to bring her back. He's got some regrets apparently, and he wants to do what he can to restore their relationship. And so he goes to Bethlehem, he meets her father-in-law, or his father-in-law, her father, and he stays there 3 days. Verse 5. It came to pass on the 4th day that they arose early in the morning, and he stood to depart. But the young woman's father said to his son-in-law, "Refresh your heart with a morsel of bread, and afterward go your way." And so they sat down, and the two of them had a donut. They ate and they drank together. It was now late in the day. The drinking and the eating had gone on for a while, and so Dad suggests that they stay another night. Then he suggests they stay another night. Then stay the next morning. Finally, verse 8, they delayed until afternoon, and both of them ate. But this time, enough was enough. Verse 10. However, the man was not willing to spend that night. So he rose and departed, and he came to opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem. Now, Bethlehem to Jerusalem was just a couple of miles. They hadn't been on the road long, but it was getting dark. It was now in the afternoon. And so his servant asked if they should lodge in Jebus or Jerusalem. The Levite says no. At the time, Jerusalem was a pagan city. It was a Jebusite city. And he assumes that it'll be safer for them in an Israelite city than in a pagan city. So they need to press on. Wow, was this a miscalculation? For it turns out, and this is a surprising thing, that the pagans were more moral than God's own chosen people at this time. Well, they end up in Gibeah, a city within the borders of Benjamin, verse 15. And when he went in, he sat down in the open square of the city, for no one would take them into his house to spend the night. Well, that's when an old man, he came out of the fields, and he approaches these two travelers, and he asks, "Where are you going, and where do you come from?" The Levite says that he's been in Bethlehem, and he's headed now to the house of the Lord. His destination is the tabernacle in Shiloh. And at the end of verse 18, he says, "But there is no one who will take me into his house, although we have both straw and fodder for our donkeys, and bread and wine for myself, for your female servant, and for the young man who is with your servant. There is no lack of anything." In other words, he was carrying ample provision. He's not going to be a burden on anyone. And with that said, the fact no one would take them in is a clue that something was wrong in Gibeah. When there's no simple hospitality among God's people, a people who've been given great hospitality by God, it's a sign that there's something terribly amiss. And the old man said, "Peace be with you. However, let all your needs be my responsibility, for do not spend the night in the open square." And we're about to discover why that would be a bad idea. And so he brought him into his house and gave fodder to the donkeys, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. Well, verse 22. As they were enjoying themselves, suddenly certain men of the city, perverted men, surrounded the house and beat on the door. They spoke to the master of the house, the old man, saying, "Bring out the man who came to your house, that we may know him carnally. Sodom and Gomorrah has come to Israel." These Benjamites were homosexual rapists. Their conscience was obviously seared. Natural sexual intercourse with a woman no longer satisfied them, and they were controlled by sexual deviance and violence. But the man, the master of the house, he went out to them and said to them, "No, my brethren, I beg you, do not act so wickedly, seeing this man has come into my house. Do not commit this outrage." Understand, in antiquity, hospitality was a sacred trust. The safety and welfare of your guest was the God-given responsibility of his host. But this old man, he goes overboard here. He shouts to the rapists, "Look, here is my virgin daughter and the man's concubine. Let me bring them out now. Humble them and do with them as you please. But to this man, do not do such a vile thing." Hospitality or not, custom or no custom, what kind of a man hands over two girls to be molested by a gang of ruthless rapists? Neither the old man or the Levite had any backbone at all. Verse 25, but the men would not heed him. And so the man took his concubine and brought her out to them, and they knew her and abused her all night until morning. And when the day began to break, they let her go. And this gives us insight as to why the concubine ran off from the man in the first place. I mean, she had probably never really been loved by this Levite anyway. The callousness and the cowardice of this man is amazing. Remember, he's a Levite. He's a man of God. And yet he grabs the girl he's supposed to love, and he throws her into the street to pacify this mob of sexual predators. Savages then spend the whole night gang raping this woman. It's only when the sun comes up that the perverts break up. You know, years ago I read a similar crime that took place in New York Central Park. It was in the news. You probably read about it yourself. A group of teenagers went wilding, as they called it. They went on a crazed rampage of mayhem and anarchy. And when an innocent jogger crossed their path, the poor lady was brutalized and gang raped. Not much has changed in 3,400 years. Recall the phrase, when God goes, anything goes. Verse 26. Well, then the woman came as the day was dawning and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was, till it was light. It seems the man had planned to just ignore the girl, but with her lying over the threshold, he can't. And so he said to her, "Get up and let us be going." How callous can you be? But there was no answer. Apparently she was dead. She had been raped and murdered as he slept. And so the man lifted her onto the donkey, and the man got up and went to his place. But on the way home, the horror of what had taken place began to sink into this man. he turned into Gibeah since it was an Israelite city. Never in his wildest imagination did he think his own brothers, God's chosen people, were capable of such atrocities. He thought about it. He mulled over it. And so when he entered his house, he took a knife. He laid hold of his concubine and divided her into 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. He dismembers her corpse, packs the bloody pieces onto a donkey, and turns it loose to go out among the 12 tribes of Israel. In other words, such a terrible crime cannot be hidden. The people need to know. Here's a form of social media for you. And this news went viral. Everybody soon learned what had happened in Gibeah. Verse 30. And so it was that all who saw it said, "No such deed has been done or seen from the day that the children of Israel came up from the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, confer, and speak up." This woman's bloody body was proof of the savagery that had occurred in Gibeah, and it got the attention of all Israel. And did you know, think about this, today, God uses another bloody body to grab the attention of all the nations. It's the crucified body of Jesus. Not the body of a concubine, a sinner, but the body of a sinless man who bore your sin and my sin for us. And so even today, he uses a bloody body to shock us, to get our attention, to speak of the savagery of our own sin and our need for a Savior. Chapter 20. And so all the children of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba. Dan was the northernmost city in Israel, Beersheba the southernmost. So from Dan to Beersheba was a way of saying from north to south, from top to bottom. As well as from the land of Gilead. The news even reached the tribes east of the Jordan River. All the Israelites came together. And the congregation gathered together as one man before the Lord at Mizpah, which was at the center of the land. And the leaders of all the people, all the tribes of Israel, presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 foot soldiers who drew the sword. Now the children of Benjamin heard that the children of Israel had gone up to Mizpah. The perpetrators, remember, in Gibeah were Benjamites. And for good reason, they weren't invited to the meeting. Of course, the children of Israel want to know how this woman was ravaged. And so the Levite, he tells his story, but with a little spin. It's interesting, he leaves out the detail of his own cruelty, how he sacrificed the girl to save his own skin. He conveniently leaves that out. Only now does he care. Something needs to be done. Verse 8. So all the people arose as one man, saying, "None of us will go to his tent, nor will any turn back to his house. But now this is the thing which we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against it by lot. We will take 10 men out of every 100 throughout all the tribes of Israel, 100 out of every 1,000, and 1,000 out of every 10,000, to make provisions for the people, that when they come to Gibeah and Benjamin, they may repay all the vileness that they have done in Israel." And so all the men of Israel were gathered against the city, united together as one man. At first, the tribes of Israel give the other Benjamites the opportunity to fight with them against Gibeah. But they refuse to turn on their fellow tribesmen. Instead, they come to Gibeah's defense. A civil war is now brewing in Israel. Israel has 400,000 troops ready for battle. Benjamin now musters 26,700 troops, and only 700 of them are from Gibeah. You'd think Benjamin and Gibeah would be overwhelmed, but a few factors are going to even out this battle. First, Gibeah was a mountainous city, and it was easily defensible. And second, apparently Benjamin had 700 left-handed slingshot sharpshooters who could hit a target, we're told, within a hair's breadth. So when the Israelites climbed the hilly terrain, the snipers, the Benjamites, could pick them off one at a time with their left-handed slingshots. And in the beginning, Benjamin prevails. They win the first two battles decisively. Israel loses 40,000 men. And why does God allow Benjamin to win these first two rounds? We're not sure. Perhaps Israel's numerical advantage made them overconfident. Maybe God needed to humble them. We're not sure. Verse 26, then all the children of Israel, that is all the people, went up and came to the house of God and wept. They'd been defeated twice. They sat there before the Lord and fasted that day until evening. And they offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. When you get defeated twice like that, when you've obviously got the advantage but still get defeated, you can conclude maybe there's something wrong between you and God. Maybe God is against you. And so they come with repentant hearts, and burnt offerings. And so the children of Israel inquired of the Lord. The Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, stood before it in those days, saying, shall I yet again go out to battle against the children of my brother Benjamin? Or shall I cease? And the Lord said, go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into your hand. God sees some humility now, and he says, give it one more try. Well, this time Israel sets up an ambush. They draw the Benjamites out of the city. Benjamin achieves some initial success. They get drawn out too far from Gibeah. Israel attacks them with 10,000 army rangers. Verse 34 tells us the fighting was fierce. But the Benjamites had strayed too far, which allowed the Israelites to set Gibeah ablaze. And when the Benjamites saw their city going up in smoke, they panicked and they were defeated. And in verse 47, but 600 men turned and fled toward the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon. And they stayed at the rock of Rimmon for 4 months. And the men of Israel turned back against the children of Benjamin and struck them down with the edge of the sword from every city, men and beasts, all who were found. They also set fire to all the cities they came to. Now, chapter 21 provides a strategic detail. Now, the men of Israel had sworn an oath at Mizpah, saying, none of us shall give his daughter to Benjamin as a wife. Well, then the people came to the house of God, and they remained there before God till evening. They lifted up their voices and wept bitterly and said, O Lord God of Israel, why has this come to pass in Israel that today there should be one tribe missing in Israel? Now they're concerned about Benjamin. The tribe of Benjamin is now 600 men short of extinction. The refugees are at Rimmon. They're the only survivors. And since they're all men, how can they replenish their tribe? Verse 6. And the children of Israel grieved for Benjamin their brother and said, one tribe is cut off from Israel today. What shall we do for wives for those who remain, seeing we have sworn by the Lord that we will not give them our daughters as wives? Remember the oath that they had taken. And they said, what one is there from the tribes of Israel who did not come up to Mizpah to the Lord? Well, see, one city had been missing from that gathering that they had had at Mizpah. The city was Jabesh-Gilead. And so to punish that city for not fighting with the other Israelites, they go and they annihilate everyone from that city except for 400 virgin daughters who they bring back to Shiloh. It was a ruthless act, really. And realize, nobody here is seeking the Lord. That's what you need to realize. Everyone is just making this up as they go. And when that happens, it becomes very, very difficult to differentiate the good guys from the bad guys. Verse 13. Well, then the whole congregation sent word to the children of Benjamin who were at the rock of Rimmon and announced peace to them. And so Benjamin came back at that time, and they gave them the women whom they had saved alive of the women of Jabesh-Gilead, and yet they had not found enough for them. There were 600 refugees at Rimmon, and they only came up with 400 daughters. And so there's 200 wives short. And the people grieved for Benjamin because the Lord had made a void in the tribes of Israel. Well, then the elders of the congregation said, "What shall we do for wives for those who remain, since the women of Benjamin have been destroyed?" And they said, "There must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin, that a tribe may not be destroyed from Israel. However, we cannot give them wives from our daughters." Why? Because of the oath that they'd taken. For the children of Israel had sworn an oath, saying, "Cursed be the one who gives a wife to Benjamin." But you see, humans can always come up with a plan. And I don't know really what to make of this. Then they said, "In fact, there is a yearly feast of the Lord in Shiloh, which is north of Bethel, on the east side of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem and south of Labona. Therefore, they instructed the children of Benjamin, saying, 'Go lie in wait in the vineyards and watch. And just when the daughters of Shiloh come out to perform their dances, then come out from the vineyards, and every man catch a wife for himself from the daughters of Shiloh, then go to the land of Benjamin.'" Now remember, Shiloh was the home of the tabernacle. "And thus the daughters of Shiloh may have been an order of single women devoted to the service of the Lord." Well, their service is now needed in a most unusual way. 200 Benjaminite bachelors lack a bride. And so the boys from Benjamin are supposed to hide in the bushes while the sisters from Shiloh start to dance. Then they're supposed to jump out and grab a wife. And I suppose live happily ever after. Hopefully the girls kept dancing and the guys kept chasing. "And after catching you a wife, then it shall be when their fathers or their brothers come to us to complain that we will say to them, 'Be kind to them for our sakes, because we did not take a wife for any of them in the war, for it is not as though you have given the women to them at this time, making yourselves guilty of your oath.' The men of Israel now can rest easy. They didn't violate their wartime vow. This was a post-war action. And these girls were never given. They were just taken by the Benjamites. Thus, their oath is intact. The men of Benjamin follow through with their plan. They restart their families and they rebuild their cities. And I'm sure you're encouraged by that story. Our CBI girls, they like to dance, square dance over there at the house over there. I'm a little worried for them now. Be careful you check the bushes out there. Make sure there's no Benjamites. And the best way to describe today's study is, what a mess. The last verse of Judges 21, verse 25 tells it best. "In those days, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes." And what was the result? Confusion, chaos, carnality, cowardice, carnage, etc. You know, they say the first lesson that an airplane pilot learns is not to trust his own eyes, not to trust his own bearings. His view from the cockpit is always limited. That's why he needs to follow the tower's instructions. And that's why when we tell folks, "Oh, live your own truth, Follow your own heart. We are destining them to crash. For we have a king. We're no longer living in a time where there was no king. We have a king. King Jesus has not left it up to us to guess at life or to wing it or to make it up as we go. We have his word and we have his spirit. And he knows best how we should live our lives. So bow before King Jesus and let him set the rules.